This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 28th of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Whether it's women's or men's, gardening or home, to accompany your TV dinner, or for the inner gourmand in you, The Stack has led you up the garden path of publishing. In and out of print, we take stock of paper at the end of the year, see what titles have been made over and which should definitely do nothing of the sort. On this week's edition of The Stack, we've sort of thrown out the script and we get down to some serious industry discussion. We review what have been the highs and lows in this varied and eclectic world of magazines and newspapers. We'll be looking at the business of selling magazines, both independent and niche, or more familiar global newsstand giants. Hello and welcome to the 70th and very special edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. I'm Tyler Brulé. Well, joining me today and helping me sift through the best and worst of 2013 in print is someone who knows a thing or two about selling magazines. He'll also be joined by a number of cohorts a little bit later in the program, but Ian Birch is the Director of Editorial Development and Special Projects at Hearst Magazines. He spent the last 8 years in New York relaunching TV Guide and working for Hearst USA. Previously, Ian launched or relaunched Red, Heat, Closer, Grazia, amongst many others. He's just shuffling his way into the studio right now, and he'll be joining us around the table. Well, as we said at the start of the show, we've slightly thrown out the format because you can do that at this time of year. And I almost should say that it was a little over a week ago. I should have just brought a whole recording unit with me to Il Barretto, which is a bit of a lunching and drinking spot down the street. More lunching than drinking on that particular day, because Mr. Ian Birch, who's with me in the studio, we sat down and we had a proper good old natter about the state of the industry, which was absolutely lovely. And we should have just turned the mics on. And now we've brought you all away back, but we should just replay that conversation.
Well, thank you for inviting me back. I loved the conversation. There's nothing I like more than talking about media.
And what are the things that really stood out? And when I was wandering back to the office, we definitely reminisced about the good old years in London, and I think also certainly some of the shifts and changes. But one of the interesting things, and we touched on it when you were on the show a while ago as well, was the need to cut the bullshit language that occupies boardrooms, and that we need to call the story. When it's a story, it's a story, and when it's great, when it's great imagery, it's just a good photograph. And I thought that was really one of the most outstanding things. And somehow, whether it's through M&A deals that have happened, and certainly all of the various types of takeovers and streamlining and everything, there is this sort of you almost need this new lexicon that exists, and yet we sort of need to get back to basics.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, because there seems to have evolved, and you mentioned it last time, a kind of boardroom language. So it's become a sort of mashup of boardroom, Harvard Business School, and tech speak.
Yeah.
So if you mash all that together, then you get this extraordinary new way of talking.
Mm.
And I was thinking about, because you'd mentioned about the trends for 2013. And I thought one of the best ways of thinking about the trends was looking at the new language that's come through.
Absolutely.
And so I was just making a list of some of the words that I find myself using slightly embarrassingly, but if you can't beat them, join them.
Yeah.
And this year was very much about words like ecosystem. Mm. So once upon a time,
we all have to be in an ecosystem.
You have to be in an ecosystem, otherwise you are a non-person.
Yeah.
But once upon a time, those would have been called brand extensions.
Yes.
But no more. It's an ecosystem.
Mm.
And then obviously multi-platform, but that kind of goes without saying. And one of the most interesting ones, I think, is the word storytelling.
Mm.
So storytelling has become...
A narrative. Yes.
Six, absolutely narrative and storytelling. But storytelling is interesting because it's such a classic traditional word, but somehow it's been reclaimed or claimed by a new kind of tech generation,
yes,
who now see it as something that's completely new and different, and storytelling is at the heart of brands, which on the one hand is brilliant, but on the other hand, it's kind of interesting they're using such a a traditional word to talk about.
And I think it's interesting how that camp has also embraced that word as well, because sometimes, you know, I do listen with a bit of a raised eyebrow, and I think of, yeah, storytelling, like you're just spinning a load of bullshit sometimes as well.
I know, absolutely. And I mean, I'm sure I'm guilty of that, just as everybody else is. But I think what's interesting is that there's also been a recent school of thought that, you know, the internet is all about, or digital is all about, a return to an oral tradition, as in what you say, as well as what you hear, but particularly what you say, as in O-R-A-L, which obviously links up with storytelling. So part of me is delighted by that, because storytelling suggests there's substance, there's a beginning, middle, and an end, there's a way to engage a reader. And so I'm kind of quite positive about that, as opposed to just always speaking in terms of metrics.
Yes.
Because enough of metrics, you know, and I know that's absolutely core to selling advertising, but there seems to be such a split between the need to drive traffic in order to get advertising,
yes,
on the one side, and then there's this Grand Canyon between that and actually the substance and the storytelling. So by using the word storytelling, if that's a way to bring back stuff that people like to read, there's an old-fashioned phrase for you.
Right.
You know, I want to read this story because it's a great story.
We're looking a little bit at the winners and losers. Now, I'm not sure if this is a loser phrase of, well, it's not just of 2013, and it's been around maybe for 5 years, I would say. But it's that question which you always get around the boardroom table, and it happens across a variety of sectors. What does success look like?
Oh, yes, I know.
And I'm thinking, well, you tell me what it looks like, because, and again, this is, you know, it's a very close cousin of metrics. Now, you know, did someone just simply buy the next issue and tell a friend about it? Is that success? You know, or is it, yeah, that we had 20 billion people visit our website, but not one person subscribed to our magazine? Is that success?
Absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think at the moment, I think the core problem behind that is, and I'm stating the obvious, but sometimes
you need to.
That's a useful thing to do. Nobody really knows what success looks like. So, yes, of course, there are extraordinary exceptions like the Uber Roman empires of Google, of Yahoo, of Facebook.
Yeah.
But they are the new Roman empires. You know, they may crumble, they may not.
Yeah.
But beyond that, we don't really know in much smaller brands what success looks like yet.
Yeah.
So we're still clinging on. And that sounds a bit desperate. And I don't mean it to sound that desperate. But still, at the end of the day, somebody buying a magazine on a newsstand is a measure of success, because they've actively participated in giving you that amount of money for the magazine. But I think, you know, we're in such a period of transition at the moment that the kind of milestones of success are sliding all over the place and nobody can really say. And so they change very quickly. So milestones of success literally can change month by month, because one month it's kind of, let's do content like BuzzFeed, or let's do an application like Snapchat. These things bubble up probably every, what, 2-3 weeks?
Exactly.
And, you know, they're all really interesting in different ways, but there's no really kind of robust business model there yet that I can see.
No, and you're not alone. I'm not alone. Going back to this notion of metrics and you know, this grand desire to be able to measure every single thing, which I think is something which has, of course, bubbled up with the digital generation. When you think, okay, I can, you know, somehow look at algorithms and everything, and therefore, and then I get a printout at the end of it, and to some people, yes, that is success. If you have a stable of magazines, and I can still probably look at a couple of publishing companies around the world, you know, is it important, Ian, to still have, you know, one or two trophy titles in the portfolio? They may not make a ton of money. They might even lose a little bit of money. But from a positioning point of view, they're there. They prop up a number of other titles, because, you know what, of course, the bottom line looks like. maybe the advertisers don't, but they, it's nice that they know that, yeah, you have a commitment to maybe it's a finishing school. You have that magazine which loses a bit of money, but God, what a hothouse of talent. And it pushes people through the ranks. And listen, there's probably no shortage of luxury goods houses as well that have great designers. But are those designers making money, for them? No. Is their handbag main business making money? Yes, it is. How important is that still, do you think?
I think it's still very important. Very important. Because I think a company is defined by the kind of brands that obviously are in that company. And different brands do different things. Mm. No brand should be expected to do one thing and one thing only. Mm. So one may supply status. One may supply scale. One may supply innovation. I'm oversimplifying, but you take my point. I think it's really important because it's all about the mix. And also increasingly, it's about collaboration. Mm. So the more that we can work together behind the scenes, the better.
Yeah.
Because why not? It's much more about being fast and mobile and agile. And I think it's there's also the other thing I don't think people should forget is, and I remember once somebody mentioned this to me a long time ago when I was working at EMAP, and they said, the thing you must never do when you're cutting staff is get rid of the house hippie. And by the house hippie, he meant the person who had all the knowledge of the brand, the feel, the ambience.
The proper oral history.
The proper oral history. So if you think about that in terms of brands within a company, sometimes brands do lose money. Well, actually, quite often brands
they
lose
do
money.
Yeah.
But they have a kind of grounding, a kind of stature, a kind of magnetic attraction that is still really important.
Yeah.
And that kind of filters throughout the whole company. So you mentioned luxury retail outlets, exactly the same. Exactly the same in the music industry. I mean, I remember several years ago when EMI were after David Bowie. Now, David Bowie at that time was actually not selling many records, despite the fact, luckily, he then went on again to sell a lot of money. Mm. And the first reason they wanted him was because he was such a kind of figurehead person. They knew that he would attract new, younger bands. Mm-hmm. And they were absolutely right, in the same way that there are certain iconic brands that literally attract people because they want to be in that universe. They want to feel the cozy glow that Harper's Bazaar gives off, or the cozy glow that, or the excitement for a younger woman that Cosmo gives off, or the luxury feel of Vogue. So I'm not saying anything unique here, but I think we should never underestimate how that continues to be a powerful force.
Yes, because we only have to look around and you can see so many companies. We can look at our own stacks at home and, many much-loved magazines you never want to throw because, they're no longer there. But you know exactly what that boardroom discussion looked like, and someone just came in and looked at the numbers and just thought, oh, that's not very good. Mm-hmm. And you take an axe through it, and maybe you could never get it into Root Health. Maybe you could get it to just take over. Maybe it'd lose a little bit of money, but was it contributing 3 or 4% to lots of other magazines? Absolutely. Mm. And it sort of reminds me of when I was at Time Inc. It seems like we lost a whole layer then. And part of it is related to the office hippie. But there were these wonderful women who were these great office managers that we had as well. And I sort of look around, that's become HR and it's become, head of people and all of these, awful things, all of this kind of new, human resources speak that you have today. But what was great about it was that oral history piece, that here you had someone who was the office manager who had to put people into rehab. She was responsible for getting the bureau chief's kids into school and doing all of these things, which now either you're supposed to go online and do them for yourself, but yet here is a woman who held a company together, and again, that sort of layer in media companies has kind of just totally been erased because either do it yourself. Or it needs to be sort of, folded into some other division of the people department.
Yeah, well, I would add to that. I think that the role of the publisher, the traditional role of the publisher, should never be underestimated because I think a good publisher does everything you're saying and more.
Mm.
So they keep the trains running. They keep the balance sheet correct. They keep certain things away from the creative people. They nurture the kind of atmosphere in which creativity happens. And more and more companies are cutting back on publishers because I think they see them as a kind of middle area, like middle management. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you look at, if Boston Consulting Group comes in, you know, which is always a bit scary,
yes,
to say the least, one of the first things they do, I'm slightly exaggerating, but only slightly.
But you
slightly,
need to. It's radio, so you,
it's
you're
radio,
allowed to.
It's radio, so I'm allowed to do that, is they look at that kind of area of middle management. Now, clearly, those people are paid reasonably well because they inevitably have been there for more than 5-10 years because that's why they are where they are. Mm. So clearly, by getting rid of a whole level of middle management, those are significant savings.
Yes.
But you also have to think very carefully about the kind of role that you're getting rid of, and the reason that a magazine or a brand or whatever comes out as effortlessly as mm-hmm. it does is often because of the publisher.
Yeah. And again, you can see someone comes in, they said, let's, you know, we'll look at this rationally. And, you know, why don't we have a super salesperson? Because they understand all of the brands. And then they don't know any of them at the same time. And as you said, you know, you spell out the personality of Cosmo versus Harper's. Well, yes, both of them might take advertising from Estee Lauder, but one might deserve 3 or 4 extra spreads a year as well. And you need that, you know, you need that degree of internal competition as well. And Cosmo is not Harper's in the case of your company.
Absolutely. And they're very, very different audiences with very, very different needs and wants and aspirations. Mm. And, you know, Estee Lauder is a huge company or whatever, a cosmetic company or whatever. They cater for all sorts of different audiences, different subdivisions. You know, I'm telling you, I'm sure everything, all your listeners know. But it's very important to keep those nuances because so much of this is about relationships and the nuances around those relationships. Mm.
Indeed, it is about relationships, which means we should probably invite some other people into the mix because you and I could just sit here and talk all day. But as this is, of course, a special edition of The Stack, we're going to be talking to Steve Watson just after the break. And he is, of course, the founder of the magazine distribution company StackMagazines.com, and also Jeremy Leslie, a familiar voice in this studio and face around Midori House as well. You're listening to The Stack. We're back after this.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city and the other kinds the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our time shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, special year-end edition of the program. Now, I was chatting to Ian Birch a little bit earlier, of course, director and of editorial development special projects at Hearst Magazines. And yeah, we could have just kept on going. But we've invited Stephen Watson in, regular on the program, or semi-regular anyway, founder of StackMagazines.com. Welcome, very good to see you.
Thanks, Tyler.
Now, for those who are not familiar with Stack Magazines, I could read everything on the script, but better that you give the pitch to our listeners today.
Okay, go.
Go.
So it's a service where people subscribe, and every month I send them a different independent magazine. You never know what you're going to get next, but you do know it's going to be a very beautiful, lovely magazine that you probably wouldn't have found otherwise.
Right. And people can't even choose genre. It's just a surprise.
Yeah, exactly. People ask about that all the time, but actually I don't think there are enough really great magazines to be able to split down like that. Whereas keeping it broad at the moment, I can really ensure the quality.
Okay, that's controversial. I'm going to invite in Jeremy Leslie as well of Mag Culture.
Hi.
You had a very interesting conference. We call it conference, forum, symposium that you did at Central St. Martin's. What do we call it?
There's not a proper name for it, but I guess conference was the one we defaulted to.
Right. But would you agree with what Stephen's saying? I mean, do you think that when you look at the plethora of what's out there, you know, would you be able to tick a genre box and then give something interesting every month?
From my point of view, I think there are probably more than 12 magazines a year that would be worthy of it. But I think the harder part is to divide them into genres that are self-evident and obvious to the possible subscriber or reader. Mm. I think that's the challenge.
Looking just a little bit back over the year, but also over the horizon as well, I thought it was great just the assembled cast that you pulled in at the conference. And I guess, were you happy enough with it that you will do it again? Because it was really interesting to see how that it rippled around the world. Here was something that was held in London, and I do want to come back and sort of talk about the role of this city and other in the print landscape. But in terms of sort of the dialogue, there were some sort of key themes, and I'm wondering what stood out for you in terms of sort of the discussion around the state of the industry, Jeremy?
I think there are a number of things. I mean, the overall feeling I had at the end of it was that there is that the people making magazines are a very particular type of person. They have a passion.
Oh, you really don't say.
But it came through so strongly amongst, you know, speaker after speaker, yourself included. It was very, very, very clear. And I think that's talking to the attendees at the end of the day. That's absolutely what they picked up on. The students, the young people that were there. I think the what was pleasing for me was seeing people from if you like the mainstream and the independent areas of publishing sharing a lot of these same subjects, which are to do with avoiding the falling into the traps of repeating trying to establish new things, of trying to reflect what you and the audience are about, rather than relying on your point about consultants and all the extraneous management layers that get involved in publishing. I think that for me was the strongest thing that came through.
Ian, that's what I found was interesting about this particular conference as well. You had the establishment was there, the big companies, and of course you had all of these proper startups as well. Hearst, you know, other big players, are you in the development mode? Because what's interesting is, when you look at sort of France right now, a lot of things going on in France, big publishers launching magazines. It's not just, coming up, let's say, bubbling up from the street. And if you look at a company like yours or maybe some of your competitors, for you, is it still developing good old magazines? Is it, let's go back to ecosystems or brand extensions? Or is it also acquisitions as well?
Well, I think it's a mixture of everything. So taking Hearst as an example. So a couple of years ago, as you probably know, Hearst acquired Hachette. So that was quite a significant thing. So we suddenly brought in titles like Elle and Elle Deco. But kind of in some ways, more interestingly, the argument around innovation and around launching. I think what's happened in the last year, 2 years in particular, is that there's been a lot of innovation within brands. So traditionally, in big publishing companies like EMAP used to be, we would launch a new title of, I don't know, every 14, 18 months. So after Q came Mojo, after Mojo came whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that publishers don't have the nerve, the money, or they just don't want to do that at the moment. So what they're doing is they're innovating a lot within the brand, which is where the dreaded ecosystem word comes in. So they're doing a huge amount of stuff that they would not have normally done, but within the brand. So say within a magazine like Elle, there's been unbelievable innovation in there under Lorraine Candy over the last year or so, which I don't think the brand has seen that kind of innovation for the last 5 years, literally 5 or 10 years. So that doesn't get the kind of exposure, the kind of press that a new launch would get. And that's, that just is what it is. So I think what's interesting is, will the next step be to actually launch a separate brand? But I think at the moment, what we're doing is we're trying to really develop all the potential of the brand. Mm. And that can be anything from print spin-offs to new digital footprints. And also, really importantly, experiences. You know, it's kind of, do I do an event? What kind of experience could that be? Where, when, and how? Mm-hmm. So that's where I think the innovation mm-hmm. is happening now. So I genuinely think it's happening, but in a slightly different way to what we are accustomed to.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you see that everywhere. And I think just the last couple of weeks, I think you mentioned it on the stat last week, the New York magazine announced its reversion from being weekly to fortnightly. And a lot of commentators immediately saw that as a negative point of view. But clearly, there's a strategy being worked through that's going to combine and ecosystem, whatever you want to call it. But they're moving forward in a sensible way to keep the print brand going alongside the huge success of their digital standing. Yeah. That for me, I mean, that's the very big, broad, you know, big weekly New York establishment magazine. But the projects like that are being as innovative as some of the smaller independent magazines now. And for me, this year has sort of crystallised a lot of thoughts around that this is a great time for magazines in this sense. I mean, there's a struggle financially and the economic outlook is very challenging, but I think that's brought about a lot of this exciting innovation.
I agree entirely. And I think the other thing that people, you know, it's very easy for to write a lazy piece about, oh God, everything's falling apart, New York goes from one, you know, from two, instead of weekly, it's bi-weekly. I couldn't agree with you more. That's kind of fatuous appraisal. Because the other thing you've got to factor in is the behavior of the consumer. So the kind of person who buys New York magazine, who's a very affluent, very media savvy, very busy East Coast resident, probably doesn't literally have the time to read that magazine every week. Mm. So they will be going to the website, they'll mm-hmm. be going to Vulture, they'll be going to The Cut, you know, all the spin-offs that they have digitally. Mm. But actually it just makes more sense to have a kind of really rich print product every 2 weeks that they actually have time to read.
Absolutely. And they were producing that fashion magazine, The Look.
Absolutely.
As a biennial for some period, absolutely. Which led to The Cut, and now The Cut's going to feed back into the fortnightly New York. It's intelligent thinking.
I was going to completely agree, I'm afraid. I think anything that allows people to put walls around a piece of time and just allows you to then focus. I mean, if I think of the emails that I get sent on a weekly basis by all sorts of great content producers, I've got a week's worth of reading just sitting in my inbox for free. So, you know, anyone who's trying to sell content at the moment needs to figure out a way to get people to make the time in their lives for it. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how good your content is, no one's going to touch it.
Oh, I was going to put you on the spot, but you almost sort of been weaseled out of it, but I'm going to do it anyway. I mean, I can we imagine a time, though, because I go to stackmagazine.com, I subscribe, and, you know, and I get this, you know, some months will be more wonderful than others, but I get this volume and I can collect it, I can pass it on because I think it's great, and then I'll go out and subscribe to it, you know, on its own. But there is the value of the physical. Do you see, and maybe the gentleman, this is, you know, for all of you, do you see a point, though, where you're just going to be able to actually charge the same amount for giving someone a unique web link?
So a code to access the content. Maybe. I mean, look, maybe one day, but I think we would need the quality of the publications before we could do that. And at the moment, that's just not there. Mm. And I think actually that might be a little bit unfair to what a lot of people are doing, because there's still, I think people making digital magazines are still working with this great burden of print magazines. And actually, they just need to let go of it and start coming up with stuff that is totally, totally its own thing. And then, once people are happy to be paying for that stuff, I'm very happy to start curating it and people can pay me for it. Mm.
Jeremy, what do you think?
Well, to answer the simple question,
I mean, I don't want you to do you down from your own business, obviously. I mean, Mag Culture, you have just, like Stephen, you've got to sell the physical thing. But whether...
No, the paywall will come.
Yeah.
It has to. Yeah. We're already seeing signs of it. I think there's more and more people are beginning to look. I mean, paywall is a clumsy term. It's just one of them anyways. But in the end, people will be more than happy to pay for content. That will happen.
Mm. Ian?
I think there's an interesting parallel what's happening in the music industry. So a friend of mine was talking about, I think it's a new Nick Cave album. and he bought it on vinyl. So he was prepared to pay extra money for the beautiful vinyl product, you know, like beautiful shiny magazine. You get the download for free. I think that's kind of a genius. I think that's a kind of genius idea. So it's sort of the corollary of that is what you're saying. Do I pay for the web link?
Exactly.
But I think if you pay for the thing that's beautiful and handsome and has been fantastically designed and has got all these amazing tactile qualities, then you get the download for free.
That's interesting because that's paying for the physical thing and getting the digital. I think what will be really interesting is when we start to consider the digital thing as the incredibly handsome, worked on thing.
And then you get something through the post as the add-on.
Maybe.
I absolutely agree. I steer clear of comparing the music business and the print business because there is this, you know, Nick Cave is the ideal artist to do that with, I think, because it reaches an age of a demographic that probably has all Nick Cave's albums.
Sure.
And the same possibly Radiohead and some of these other bands. And I also think the music is different in that it's always gone through different media. And what I see happening is people being being prepared to the quality of digital content improving to the point where people are going to be prepared to pay for it.
Yeah.
That's the challenge before us all. And that's going to happen.
It will happen. I mean, I agree with you. I think it will definitely happen.
We just need to have some nice devices as well, or at least better devices than the ones we have now as well, I think, to make the whole experience complete. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24, going away for a very short break, and we'll be continuing with this discussion right after this.
Stand back from your letterboxes and tone up your biceps because the biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to hit subscribers' doormats and newsstand shelves. The December-January issue helps you bid farewell to 2013 and look over the horizon to 2014 with our soft power survey, the Monocle 100, and our travel top 50.
In the affairs section, we sit down for a series of interviews with global heavy hitters, from the President of Chile to the Australian Foreign Minister. We take a look at the Mexican President's to-do list, look at Japan's agenda for 2014, and ask 10 writers, academics, and economists to give us their predictions for the year to come.
In the business section, we visit three model factories that are working inspirations for their industries. From a shoelace factory in Hanover built by the early modernist Walter Gropius, to a restored Renaissance village in Umbria making knitwear, and a Japanese brand that's so transparent, its customers are invited to pitch their tents on the lawn outside. These are companies who've created beautiful, light-filled environments for their production lines and are reaping the benefits as a result.
The Monocle December-January double issue is on newsstands now.
Ed, welcome back to the special year-end edition of The Stack. My guests today are Stephen Watson of StackMagazines.com, Jeremy Leslie of Mag Culture, and Ian Birch, special projects director at Hearst Magazines. Now, I wanted to, of course, maybe at this time of year, you know, people are, you know, they've had all of their holiday trimmings, et cetera, and they're looking for any excuse to get out of the house. Steve, in your case, you bring them all of the great titles through their door. And hopefully, of course, they go off and explore them. And as I said, you know, maybe they subscribe or go and find them on the newsstand. If you look back over the last year, maybe give us a couple of hints over the horizon as well. What have been some of the standout titles that you've sent out this year, and what can we expect next year?
One of the things I'm always amazed by with sending the mags out is that when they hit, which is just now for this month, we start to get Twitter flaring up and Instagram flaring up with people saying, "Ah, my mag." And the amazing thing is that every month you get almost the same level. So there's no single month that stands out as kind of this is the one. And that's amazing because the mags are so different from each other. You would expect that one kind of wins out. Personally, for me, I actually really love this month's magazine. I better not say what it is because some people won't have had it yet.
Okay.
So I need to stay quiet on that. But it's incredibly innovative and doing a lot of very good, exciting stuff.
But if you look back then, let's not give that one away, but what have you liked over the past months, though?
Well, so I should actually break off from Stack and talk about Mags more generally. I think when that hit, that was actually the first of the... That kind of spurred me into making my weekly Stack videos. So I now do a two-minute video review of a mag every Tuesday. And it was getting Fat that just made me think, I've been expecting this magazine for so long. I knew it was coming. And it arrived, and it was actually, it exceeded my expectations so far. I thought, I've got to do something to show people why I think this is good.
And for people who haven't seen it, an incredible creation out of Finland. And I just think as covers go and, just creating and something which, Fat, not necessarily, Fat, good term in magazines, you like a good Fat magazine. Oftentimes not so flattering, but there was just something so modern and sharp about it. And I actually picked it up in Finland and thought it was absolutely great. Jeremy?
Two things stand out for me. First of all, and it goes back to the conference, is the rise in new women's magazines. If I had to pick one single magazine, I'd pick The Gentlewoman. It's been around for several years, but I think this year it's really improved. Hit its stride.
Yeah.
It's not just the independent magazine or the women's magazine, it's the magazine of the year as far as I'm concerned. But behind that, there's Libertino, Cumley have been around for a while, but also just recently Riposte, which is a really interesting new launch in the women's sphere, which deals with, as the name suggests, it searches out the women that created or involved in projects that are usually accredited to men, and points out that women were involved in too. So it is truly a riposte. So that's one thing that I think we're going to see more of. And also the idea of the kind of hyper-local magazine. So Flaneur came out, Flaneur from Berlin, which looked at one street, Kantorstrasse, and tell stories that are kind of more general and global by looking at that one street.
And then you have then Der Wedding as well.
And Der Wedding continues to do
another,
that.
Another neighborhood in
Absolutely,
Berlin as well.
Yeah.
It needs its own magazine.
But in America, there's Local Quarterly.
Yes.
There's a number of projects which are looking... I mean, I think we've seen, in the independent sphere, we've had a lot of magazines that use cycling or cars or fashion, various things to look at... The personal through the general, and now we're seeing these magazines which are more using the really, really local to talk about the global, and I think that's a really interesting trend that comes out of the web and will continue.
Ian, if you look back or even over the horizon, I mean, you might have your ear to the ground to a couple of things that are about to launch, as well as just good old things that you thought you also had to maybe forward to colleagues and say, guys, look at this. I mean, this is something which is really, truly fantastic.
Right. Well, I mean, the moral of this story at the moment is I'm going to subscribe to Stack.
There's so many of these.
So hey, you've got I plead the fact I haven't been living here for the last year, which I know is a weak excuse. So I say that straight away. I mean, I am still an unashamed supporter of some of the big mainstream magazines.
I was hoping you're going to fight that corner. Good.
I absolutely am going to fight that corner. It's not that I don't love all the new stuff coming through. I do, but I feel I'm not as informed as I should be. But I still think magazines like The New Yorker are very hard to beat.
Mm-hmm.
I would hate it if I didn't get my copy every week.
Absolutely.
Though
that's,
I get that, it online
one,
now.
And that's one you don't want to see go bi-weekly.
I so don't want it to go bi-weekly, but fingers crossed. I mean, we talked about New York magazine.
Yeah.
I still think it is something that nobody else has beaten in terms of, you talk about local going global. I couldn't agree with you more. I had heard of Flaneur, and I'm fascinated by that. I had seen that. But I think New York is an extraordinary example of something that can dive so deep into actually... really just Manhattan. It's barely five boroughs. But through that, they somehow give you a global picture of what a certain kind of America is like in 2013.
I always wonder, maybe it's an interesting note to end on, at least, spur people on to launch something new. It often sort of comes up and many sort of say they're going to be, and I don't want to make the conversation too parochial about London. But nevertheless, if you can talk about sort of neighborhoods in Berlin, we can talk for a moment about, why is there not a New York magazine for London? Because you would think, given just the global nature of the city, and of course, likes to slug it out with New York anyway, You think there is the journalistic talent here, and in one way, you know, the Evening Standard tried to have that mantle, you know, when they went sort of, you know, glossy with their, you know, with their supplement, etc. But it hasn't happened. So, I mean, I want to go round the table on that one, but I'll start with you, work our way back in. What do you think?
Well, obviously, time out. There is time out. But Time Out has gone through various changes. We know it's now gone free.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of beast to what it was.
And just much more listy and not that journalism, I guess, either.
No, I mean, you know, I don't in any way criticize them as such, but it's a very, you know, it was born in a very different era, went through many different eras, and is now in a completely different era.
I do think Time Out had its moment where it might have done, but it lacked the ambition.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I think to your point about that's a huge opportunity to launch something that local and that detailed online, because I would subscribe to something like that because I miss those kind of really kind of in-depth, dynamic, local political coverage. And I mean political with a small p around the big P, you know. And I think that would be something that would be an amazing opportunity to do in a purely digital way,
except
unshackled
the thing that, because obviously this is the question that sort of plagues people who love magazines living in London, and whenever I think about it, I think, well, you've got your distribution sorted out. This is the thing that you should be doing in print, because it's be so easy to get it out to the people who need it. They're in a tiny little area, so it would be an amazing opportunity. In terms of why it hasn't happened, Well, I don't know. I guess in New York, you've got the New York Times. You've got that kind of, you know, in London, well, I guess all of the British newspapers are essentially the London newspaper. Mm. So maybe that's...
You've got your arms crossed there, like, you're not buying it.
It really upsets me that we don't have that. But New York comes from a time when it was, you know, I mean, it grew out of a newspaper supplement in the 60s. It's been around for 40, 50 years. To launch something now... I mean, I used to work at Time Out, and I have a lot of time for it as a brand and such. But I think they had their moment, but they were blocking the space. They held that space for so long. They were distributing the magazine. They were making the magazine weekly. Nobody could come in. They saw off all comers. But then they didn't actually go the full length and make it as special as it might have been. So it would have to be digital now, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's maybe not sort of the best words down on a show about print. But anyway.
I still think print.
Okay, very good. We have to leave it there. Jeremy Leslie of Mag Culture, Stephen Watson of stackmagazines.com. If people have not bought their Christmas presents yet, then I will guide everyone to your website. Or there's no shortage, of course, of certainly titles to subscribe to. Also from the Hearst stable, Ian Birch, Director of Editorial and Special Projects at Hearst Magazines. Gentlemen, have a fantastic new year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When I come back, I'd be in a lot of trouble if I didn't give, of course, the last words to all things when it comes to magazine design and fine stock and ink to our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell. He'll be with us right after this.
There's a saying in Mexico, for everything bad, mezcal. For everything good, the same. Monocle Films visits Oaxaca to meet the people injecting new life in an ancient beverage, taking mezcal from small Mexican villages to the world's capital.
Most mezcals are produced by families in their villages, in small batches using traditional methods handed down through generations. Mezcal is traditionally a farmer's drink, a working class spirit, but it's also one steeped in folklore and a particularly Mexican sense of magic and mysticism.
Liquid Courage, in the film's menu on Monocle.com.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the Global Pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
a grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And it is almost time to crack open the champagne, not just because our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, is here. We're a couple of days away, of course, from the end of actually what's been a very good year. And we're looking over the horizon. I think it's going to be a very interesting 2014, exciting 2014. And we're going to narrow the discussion, listeners, to, of course, talk a little bit about our brand and business as well. But I can see, Rich, you brought in some other covers as well. Maybe you want to talk about March. We're looking at our March 2013 cover, and maybe you want to remind listeners if they don't remember exactly what issue that was.
Absolutely. So our March cover, it's a German-themed issue. It's a German special, country that's close to our hearts, actually. One of my favourites. It does
us. And also, yeah, and a country which it was unique to really sort of devote a cover in this way, I guess, as well. A whole issue, let's say.
Yeah, a whole issue. And it's a good issue, I think. My March issues tend to do very well. I'm not sure whether it's coming back from Christmas and we're well rested, or I don't know. It's a New Year's resolution. We're all fit and healthy again. Mm. But either way, March does well. And this particular issue I bought in because I love the cover. And it's one of those moments where of course, we're independent, which means we don't have people looking over our shoulders telling us what to do, focus groups, all those things, so we can be nice and disposable with our kind of ideas. And this is just a great idea of we put a gummy bear on the cover. And it's just a really nice part of being in an independent publishing company, because we can just do what we want. Mm-hmm. And we just took a punt. Everyone loved it. It sold really well. It's surprising. It puts a little smile on your face. And I just think it's a really unusual way to celebrate Germany.
Yeah. And it was really sort of for our editor, Andrew Tuck, a real high point for him, because he got some proper German cheesy cover lines in there. We've got the winking gummy bear with, of course, a classic Tuckism, "Ich bin ein Berliner." and then also, and then at the bottom as well, the Federal Republic's softest power asset as well.
Yeah. And just, you know, I think there's a kind of litmus test with a cover, and that's when people stop by your desk and they can't wait to talk to you about the cover. And that was one that everyone in the office who was looking over my shoulder and saw that cover design came over, or they saw it on the printer. Everyone loved it. And you kind of know you're onto a winner then, I think.
Yeah. And we shouldn't probably give too much away, but we're going to continue with this this national theme as well. Not German national theme, but we've got another country coming up for March. We shouldn't give it away. Do you think you're going to be able to top yourself with this one?
I hope so. I think it's a strong country, and a lot of sort of visual references there. Mm. A lot of things we can draw upon. So nice colour palette in the flag.
Very good colour palette in the flag.
I'm up for the challenge.
And I think it's got some good, it's got some sort of good raw ingredients as well to have, I think, come up with a good cover.
Yeah, and I think there's people have an affinity for this said country, or not said country, and I think people warm to it.
Excellent. You've got two other titles, one which comes up from time to time, and I'm always sort of loath to talk about Popeye too much, because I just feel it's like our own little secret, but of course it's not. It's become a very successful title, of course, on the Japanese newsstand, much loved around the world now, particularly after the relaunch. And you've this one particular cover that you've brought in, and then we just remind people this is part of the Magazine House stable of titles, and they went for this relaunch with this tagline, "Popeye, the magazine for city boys."
Yeah, I think for anyone who wants to be in publishing, magazine design, a journalist, I think this is just a cover par excellence. It is, there's no eye contact. It's a handsome, well-styled gentleman taking a sip of a coffee. And it's got a cover line underneath, "How to be a man." And I just think that is just so genius and brilliant. I just think it's a great bit of writing. It kind of pulls you in. It's warm. Mm. I just want to buy it. And I think that's the objective of a cover.
Yeah. At every level, I think, from the exceptional styling, and this guy is in this slightly tweedy jacket, and he has a rep tie on, and the pocket square, and then this, you know, I don't know if it's a Monte Grappa or if it's a Mont Blanc, but this, you know, really hefty pen in his pocket. Great eyewear. The coffee cup is right. But I think the thing that stood out when I saw this on the newsstand was just, it's so cozy. It is, you want to, you know, yeah, you in one way you want to be him, and you want to be in that environment. I want to know where they shot this. I always want to have that kind of lighting no matter where I go in the world. And it, as you said, it just nails everything that a cover is supposed to do.
Yeah, and I just think it's a great example of, I mean, you don't have to put George Clooney on your cover and say, here is style, this is panache, and use a foil and put it in a bag and use a fluorescent. You know, you can do it with white ink, a handsome young man and a great bit of styling and a genius cover line. And I just think it is just exceptional.
Finally, you've got your last title. And is this a cover story or what's on the inside?
I just think it's... I mean, I'm being indulgent. It's just a favourite. I just love this magazine. Outstanding. I think it's just a really good name. It's really smart. I love the colour. It's bright blue. It's bold, simple. Maybe a little bit borrowed from Gentlewoman, maybe slightly the design. But I just think it's a sports magazine.
Or maybe Gentlewoman borrowed from them. You never know.
You never know, yeah. And I just think... that's how you, if you were going to do a sports magazine, do it like that. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And the name, as you said, you know, it's, that's what I think also the Japanese are really good at too, is also being able to, just play on words in a way that I don't think in a Western context, we would never do an outdoor sport magazine and call it Outstanding. I don't know, sort of the mechanics of the brain, we would never get there.
I know that there is, you're right. You're absolutely right. There's a weird kind of ghost in the machine thing that happens when a Japanese person thinks about something in English and then something comes out and it's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, brands like Tomorrowland, it's just excellent, excellent things. They're warm, they're charming, and it's bizarre. I don't quite understand it. I think there's something within Japanese culture, they're very good at reinvention. You can go to an Italian restaurant or a French restaurant in Tokyo and it'd be better than one in Italy. You know, you can look at a bit of kind of tailoring in Japan and it can be better than something on Savile Row.
For sure.
Or Milan. And you just think, well, you know, how did they pull that off?
Yeah. And I also like as well that, Outstanding is produced by Doubt Everything. And I think just that idea of that sort of, you know, the skepticism tagline is really interesting as well. What are you looking forward to next year, Rich? Aside from our 2014 March cover.
Doing more covers, actually. This year, I've really enjoyed doing Monocle covers. I think we've taken them, we always take them seriously, but it's a nice moment in the magazine's monthly cycle. I'm looking forward to doing covers. I'm looking forward to doing some tweaks.
Yeah.
Hopefully some bigger publishing projects.
Yeah, and for people listened to Section D as well, will know that when March arrives, there's going to be a slight tweak, and it's not a redesign. It is it's really just like the magazine's had a really good holiday. It's going to have a splash of sunshine. Maybe use a good moisturizer. No invasive nip and tuck surgery. But that's maybe the last question today. Do you want people to notice, or should it sort of just be this just looks better?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's that kind of, like you say, you've had a summer holiday. You go back to school. You got a little bit of a tan, you're a bit slightly more handsome, you got a new coat, something, new pair of shoes, you just look a bit cooler.
Hope you didn't pork out.
Exactly. Well, it's Christmas, so I'll try my best.
You never know. Richard Spencer-Powler, creative director, also thanks to our other guests, Ian Birch, Stephen Watson, and Jeremy Leslie. Our producer was David Pleasant, and behind the glass wall, and she's probably, you know, well on her way, or at least packing her bags, heading back to New Zealand, just temporarily, though, our studio manager, Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time in 2014. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, for me, Tyler Berlay, have a very, very good New Year, and we'll see you in 2014. Goodbye.